This piece that we just heard, The Canticle of Brother Sun, by Jim Scott and Paul Winter, the composers wove two sacred texts together. Actually, probably more than that, but I'll just focus on these two. One source is the praise song of the 12th century friar and saint Francis of Assisi, which he originally titled The Canticle of the Creatures. And in this hymn, he praises the divine for the magnificence of creation, and he conceives all the elements in creation, sun, moon, earth, wind, water, fire, flora, and fauna, everything as personified and kindred, all beings kindred. And they are all brothers and sisters to humanity, and it's a song of overflowing gratitude and humility, recognizing the glorious beauty and inherent wisdom present in nature and humanity's dependence upon creation for life. And then the second element that Jim Scott and Paul Winter wove into their piece is a text from the book of Job. Ask the animals and they will teach you, or the birds in the sky and they will tell you, or speak to the earth and it will teach you, or let the fish in the sea inform you. Scott and Winter finish the phrase by saying that if we ask, they will tell us of the beauty of the earth. And that is surely true. However, the book of Job, it contains many stanzas of extraordinary poetry to the magnificence and power and danger of the natural world. But the actual intention of the writer of Job was to proclaim the irresistible power of the divine hand and will, which he tells us is behind everything in nature. So I just felt like I should acknowledge that they took a liberty by making it about the beauty of the earth. That wasn't really the intention of the original writer. Nevertheless, the very important word that's in these lines is the word ask. Ask the animals. Ask the birds of the air. Speak to the earth, and it will respond. Let the fish of the sea tell you what they know. We have to ask, we have to listen, we have to be curious in order to learn what our kindred have to tell us. In both cases, in the lines of St. Francis and in these lines from Job, we're encouraged to understand ourselves in a creation that is always fully communicative, but humanity not necessarily comprehending. It's humanity's work to be awake to what is being communicated. But humanity lives as if we had only to listen to ourselves. And even that we don't do very well. There are various ways for us to do this listening to the earth, to pay attention to what the earth and the non-human citizens, its non-human citizens, are saying. There's our vast interconnecting fields of science that make the best use of technology to monitor the condition of species and ecosystems, to track geologic activity and weather patterns, testing the temperatures of air currents and ocean currents, using satellite photos to track receding glaciers or deforestation or animal migration patterns, monitoring seismic waves traveling through the Earth's crust or mantle. And all of these forms of asking and listening, so to speak, are crucial to human understanding of the state of the earth and the health or the disease of the community of life. And so we have to be grateful for the science and the scientists that are committed to making the translation for us. But there's another kind of asking and listening that can be more intimate, closer to home, and possible for anyone to cultivate. And it's first simply just slowing down enough to be with and notice the things of nature that share the world with us. The trees along the sidewalk as we walk to the train, the squirrel or the sparrows in the branches, the geese overhead, the snowdrops, the scent of the air, the sound of water. And remember that there is a universe which is unconcerned with emails, deadlines, appointments, news, human efforting and strife and creativity, and that lives and communicates and interconnects entirely on its own terms, all around us, even as it has to adapt to some extent to our terms, but it exists entirely on its own terms all the time and is ever present. And that's the most basic stage of mindful appreciation. And speaking for myself, this simple exercise is hard to remember to do. It means unplugging one's mind from human concerns and chatter. But trying to do this also breaks the spell that tells us that only human life, only the human world matters. And if one wants to remember that human beings once knew the world, the world's life as kindred, that human beings once felt bodily their dependence upon an embeddedness in that community, then one needs to slow down even more. Slow down more often and practice a more subtle form of attention. And that's the kind of sacred and intuitive awareness that Sue and Arthur Chapman Melanson do as they walk on their land, listening and observing and asking and giving thanks. Incidentally, when they learned that we were seeking sap for a sacred ritual to celebrate the season in the trees, they wouldn't let me pay for it. Sue said, "That's just not the way." I contacted them because I happened to be traveling in Maine earlier in the week. I just found them on the internet. They were close to where we were staying. And I thought I'd see if I could acquire some sap while I was there, because this has been a worrying season for our local maple syrup producers in Massachusetts. The warm winter and the wild temperature fluctuations have disrupted the trees, their normal sap production, their normal flow, and it's become completely unpredictable, so they don't know how their season is going to unfold. And I'm sure they, as we, are all wondering if this is a sign of things to come. Even farther north, there's been less snow and higher temperatures than usual. I actually just want to throw in one more little piece of information about the farm that we got our sap from. They use a very high-tech instrument called a reverse osmosis machine. And so as wonderful as maple syrup is, it's often produced by just enormous amounts of wood being burned. And so there's a very high carbon output in the production of maple syrup. So they use this machine called a reverse osmosis machine, which actually draws a good percentage of the water out of the sap before it gets boiled. So it drastically diminishes the carbon output in the production of the maple syrup. And so it's a wonderful expression of the joining of the old ways and the new ways, and what happens when we listen to what the earth needs and try to find a reconciliation between human life and the natural world. So this is the fifth year that we've had the Rising Sap Communion. And one of my own preparations for the service, one of the things that I particularly enjoy about it is that it gives me an excuse to go out into the woods, both if I happen to be the person who acquires the sap for the ceremony, which I like to do for the fun of it, but also to collect the bittersweet branches that decorate the altar, and in this case, the birch branches that are in the flower arrangement. And by walking in the woods and along the swollen streams or rivers, by walking in the rain and the mud and in the crystally late winter snow in my warm boots, and by smelling and feeling and listening and tasting and watching and touching and being touched, I understand better what I'm doing when I come into the sanctuary and invite all of us to taste the sap. I have to and I want to make this bodily, sensory connection to what gives this morning's ritual its reality and its sacred power. And so the wet trees and the rushing, trickling waters and the cold stones and the gray sky and the calls of the geese are with us as we taste the life of the tree. But also one of the things that I experience in doing this preparation is the acute awareness that this is not typical of my life. To make sensory contact with the natural world, to consciously smell and taste and touch and watch and listen to wild things. In the reading by David Abrams, he unpacks the idea that our own human language evolved out of our embodied experience of the natural world. Now, there are countless theories about how language developed in its first origins, but it seems likely to me that our hominid ancestors, in developing sounds to refer to the things of their world, would use sounds that expressed their experience of those things. So the word for water would have expressed the feeling or the sound of water, and the word for deer would have communicated a direct experience of that creature, and the word for a particular bird might imitate its call, and the word for lightning would have expressed the drama of flash and crack and charge and power. Our bodies can be reminded that we were once related to the world through the senses. Not intellectually, not conceptually, but we communicated with it directly and vividly. And by remembering, and I mean this in the sense that Mary Daly, the feminist theologian, uses the word remembering, that is connecting something that has been dismembered. By remembering our lost knowledge, our lost kindred, our sense of communion with wild things, we take the first necessary steps toward learning to live responsively, harmoniously in the web. And I would say with any form of justice, any form of reconciliation work, we will not be moved to become activists if we haven't identified with the needs, with the plight, or with the suffering of fellow beings, those whose circumstances may be different from our own. So we have to connect at a heart level, at the level of feeling, at the level of experience, at the level of getting it bodily, that something is wrong. And this gives us the passion to act on behalf of someone or something else that is struggling or suffering. And it's the same thing with the earth. We have to connect. We have to let it in. We have to stop long enough to hear, to witness, and to feel, to identify with. And then we are pulled out of our self-absorption enough to have our own, to have passion and compassion, and to have our conscience aroused. This has been a very strange winter, and the natural world is communicating. Are we willing to listen to what it's telling us? I'm just going to close with a poem by Rainer Maria Rilke from his Book of Hours as translated by Anita Barrows and Joanna Macy from the German. How surely gravity's law, strong as an ocean current, takes hold of even the strongest thing and pulls it toward the heart of the world. Each thing, each stone, blossom, child is held in place. Only we in our arrogance push out beyond what we belong to for some empty freedom. If we surrendered to Earth's intelligence, we could rise up rooted like trees. And instead, we entangle ourselves in knots of our own making and struggle lonely and confused. So like children, we begin again to learn from the things, because they are in God's heart. They have never left it.